That these richer terms have always implied a metaphysics raises other questions to be dealt with in their own right, but which do not in any case impinge on the question of the meaningfulness of words like conscience, mind, and self. This recent anthropology is an instance of the phenomenon I spoke of earlier, the emergence of devouring voids with their potent tendency to generalize emptiness. The center of Puritan individualism was the conscience, so sacred that it was the foundation of their definition of freedom. The much-revered William Ames, Shakespeare's contemporary, says, "Conscience bindeth according as it is informed of the will of God. For in itself it hath the power of a will of God, and so stands in the place of God himself. And conscience bindeth a man so straitly that the command of no creature can free a man from it. And the conscience is immediately subject to God and his will, and therefore cannot submit itself unto any creature without idolatry." Flavel says, "View the conscience and thoughts with their self-reflective abilities, wherein the soul retires into itself, and sits concealed from all eyes but his that made it, judging its own actions, and censuring its estate, viewing its face in its own glass, and correcting the indecencies it discovers there. Things of greatest moment and importance are silently transacted in its council chamber between the soul and God, so remote from the knowledge of all creatures that neither angels, devils, nor men can know what is transacted there." The conscience is enlightened by acceptance of the gospel, according to Ames, but a law of nature, or a law of God, is naturally written in the hearts of all men. His essay, he says, is offered that I might do something whereby the unlearned and such as are destitute of better help might somewhat be helped. This suggests Shakespeare's audience, the literate unlearned, that remarkable population to whom Shakespeare, as well as these popular theologians, could speak so brilliantly and with such confidence. I have been reading the classic Puritans to understand Edwards's spiritual and intellectual world, but clearly they are at least as relevant to an understanding of the whole literature of the English Renaissance. The workings of the conscience are a primary interest of Shakespeare's drama, where the word conscience recurs frequently. He can always reasonably be supposed to share and address the interests of his audience without presuming to identify his religious thinking or his politics. Let us say that conscience, like soul or mind, is socially constructed, the product of a particular cultural history. Or let us say it has the kind of reality conceded when a certain part of the brain lights up in an experimental subject who summons a guilty memory. In either case, there is nothing in the experience that anchors it in unequivocal meaning. Ames, in his treatise on the conscience, says that conscience, though erroneous, binds always so, that he that doth against it sins. The reason is because he that doth against conscience doth against God's will, though not materially and truly, yet formally and by interpretation, because what the conscience doth declare, it declareth as God's will. So even while the fallibility of the conscience is granted, its sanctity as a mediator between the mind and God is so great that one sins in doubting or disregarding it. To bring such seriousness to the negotiation of one's moral and ethical life might interfere with good times as currently defined, but on the one hand, it invites the highest degree of interest in and respect for the singular experience of one's self and one's circumstances, and on the other, it can somewhat supplant the fear of hell as an inducement to seeking a relationship with God. Shepherd says, "It is not a slavish fear of hell that converts people who abhor to live like slaves in Bridewell to do all for fear of the whip." He goes on to describe the terrors inflicted by an offended conscience, true, but a troubled conscience is one's own, defending one's integrity and moral competence, perhaps rescuing one's soul. It had a central place in the strenuous drama of Puritan life. Whether the conscience is or was indeed only a social construct is the kind of thing that will never be established finally one way or the other. But for purposes of argument, let us say this is a correct understanding of it. We know it can require different behaviors in different cultures, and we know that the Puritan conception was supported by an anti-authoritarianism that made them dissenters, nonconformists, and revolutionaries. It is the linchpin of the kind of spiritual autonomy that came with the rejection of priestly confession and absolution, together with other rites and mediations of the Catholic Church. These rejections had been current in suppressed popular religious belief in England at least since John Wycliffe in the 14th century, so their implications were well thought out by the 17th century and were central to a tradition whose heroes of conscience are memorialized in John Fox's Acts and Monuments of the Martyrs. It is clear that the concept had a powerful formative history for Puritans, which would differentiate their understanding of it from others in fundamental ways. To this extent, it is certainly socially constructed. In all its variant forms, it has had great importance in Western civilization, as have mind, self, and soul, which, despite their great potency as ideas, are now regarded as mere constructs. If we grant the plausibility of this view of things, then in doing so, we acknowledge not only that these concepts can be, as it were, deconstructed, but also that other concepts of mind and self can supplant them, new constructions that grow out of presently authoritative models of reality. For Freud, the conscience or superego is the internalization of an oppressive father figure. For the neo-Darwinists, it is a part of the system of self-deception that, for whatever reason, hides our inevitable selfishness from us. Models like this radically undercut the old assumption that a human mind has a faculty oriented toward truth and ready to offer testimony against the mind itself when it is erring, misguided, or corrupted, though the mind or the subjectivity, or whatever we call it now, is assumed always to be erring, misguided, and corrupted, which makes the word truth meaningless, since our own perception and acculturation are obstacles to our determining the truth in any case, which in turn means, by these lights, that truth itself cannot be said to exist. All this can sound very sophisticated, except when it comes from the mouth of a politico who says we are beyond fact-based reality, or an undergraduate who declares a staunch preference for his own truth, also not fact-based. We have stepped from a metaphysics into a void. Whether the state of things we have entered was inevitable, or whether we could have constructed something out of culture and history that would have borne our weight and shown us a serviceable enough true north, no one can say. But here we are. Do we owe good art or good information or freedom of conscience to a humankind that cannot be assumed to have any natural affinity to the true or the good? We are gazing these days at an abysmal no. However, the fact is to be understood. Traditions of thought do pass down through time, the traditions relevant here being so-called modernism and the endlessly consequential anti-history that abolishes context and fosters incomprehension on subjects of such intrinsic interest that on this basis alone they should be acknowledged and studied. This consuming ignorance is beyond any account I can offer for it, but it does feast, black hole fashion, on the humanist heritage preferentially, as it did when the classical tradition gave way to the Dark Ages. The ways we think do themselves deserve thought. For example, if concepts with religious history such as soul and conscience can be sufficiently redescribed in other language, this in no way diminishes their reality. If they might be redescribed and are not, then we should wonder why they are not, how their exclusion from the vocabulary of self-declared humanism is rationalized, and what the effects of the exclusion might be. If they cannot be redescribed in a non-religious language, then we need to consider what is threatened or lost when religious language is lost. For the Puritans, conscience as a concept put the mind or soul in relation to God. It made the self an object of scrupulous contemplation, and it created a sanctity around the individual that assured important liberties. Our sample of existence, that is, the growing sum of whatever we can observe, test, describe, derive, or know in any meaningful sense, is too small and untypical, too contaminated with error and assumption, too prejudiced by accident and limitation to yield a metaphysics. Yet we need a metaphysics, an unconfirmable parallel reality able to support essential concepts such as mind, conscience, and soul, if we are to sustain the civilization, culture, and history created for us. To quote Flavel, "The soul of the poorest child is of equal dignity with the soul of Adam." All men are created equal. Nothing about these statements is self-evident, yet they can shape and create institutions, and they can testify against them when they fail. They have only their own beauty and the beauty of their influence to affirm them. Considering the Theological Virtues. The Lang Lectures at Regent College, Vancouver, BC, February 8, 2017. Faith. I have been asked fairly often over the years why I choose to identify myself with religion. It is an unusual choice now for a novelist who writes for a general non-sectarian readership. But what is usual is not really any kind of constraint. It is the merest cobweb waiting to be brushed away, insofar as it makes itself felt at all. There are a great many fine books in the world, more every year, so if some readers are turned away from mine by my choice of subject, they are at no risk of deprivation. The answer to this question is, of course, that religion is a very central interest of mine, and I have never seen any reason to look away from a subject to which I am so strongly attracted. Several things are going wrong here already. The word interest does not really describe my tropism toward the vast field of experience and thought and expression I call religion, for want of a better word. Nor is subject an appropriate term for something so minutely rich and so cosmically enveloping. I have adopted myself into an old Protestant tradition, once important in England and America, now relatively unknown in the world at large and in America as well. On the one hand, it has a rich and brilliant theology and a remarkable history, and on the other hand, it is so small a part of Christendom that I can be comforted and reassured that it is indeed only a part of this vast and various world presence we call the Church and the great religions. While my thinking is Christian, it has led me to a kind of universalism that precludes any notion of proselytizing. It would shake my faith in the goodness of God if I were to believe that His particular favor was reserved to members of my denomination. This is to say, I feel no conflict or contradiction between religion broadly considered and religion narrowly considered. Furthermore, I know from experience that very secular people can take a generous interest in religion and be highly sensitive to the beauty of it. That is, when its exponents are also aware of its beauty, as too often they seem not to be. So it is conventional among contemporary writers to exclude religion from their work, however religious the writers might in fact be. This reticence seems to be regarded by many as a courtesy, an acknowledgement of the fact that the subject can be painful or private, or can stir prejudices or hostilities. Such scruples are respectable, certainly, but they tacitly reinforce the assumption that religion is essentially and inevitably divisive. So this assumption is rarely tested. It has not been my experience that the response to my books among Catholics or Jews or Muslims is in any degree less generous than that of readers whose traditions are closer to mine. The feeling of an overplus of meaning in reality, a sense that the world cannot at all be accounted for in its own terms, is a profound bond and understanding between and among religious people. It is universal in religions to grant the meaningfulness of metaphysical thought. They all query being itself. Granting conflict, but there is always conflict, and to treat it as something peculiar to religion is simply uninformed. Most of us must know that religion uniquely denounces and condemns violence. To what effect we cannot know, since history is infused with religion and might well have been much darker without it. In any case, to be able to acknowledge this profound and beautiful shared assumption that there is indeed an overplus of meaning would be to respect something very near the hearts of people we are too ready to think of as alien in every sense. Religion could quiet our antagonisms if we let it be what it is fundamentally and at best. It is because of the strange state of religion and of the conversations surrounding it that I feel obliged to account for the fact that my preoccupations are the subject of my work. To me, this seems simply appropriate. If they had narrowed my audience, no matter. I really never expected an audience. When I discovered I did have one, I took this to mean that I had their permission to write as I chose. My mind and my books have passed through life together, in conversation, so to speak. This pleases me. The resistance I have been warned to expect is not real, so far as I can tell. The warning seems to be no more than an instance of a dogged tendency to resent injury in anticipation, undeterred by the fact that the injury never comes, or that it has only the long life and broad application of anecdote, or that it is so slight as to be negligible, if it is even real. People live and die stifled by fears of hostility or ridicule, the elves and ogres of contemporary consciousness. These dreary and trivial anxieties encourage dark prejudgments of people at large. They seem to be particularly characteristic of people who call themselves Christian, though they discourage faith, hope, and love, which in this particular case would certainly drive out fear. I think and write about religion because I am religious. It occurred to me early in life that I wanted to align my life with things that seemed true to me. My always important brother once told me that according to Jonathan Edwards, we should never allow ourselves a thought we would not entertain on our deathbeds. Stark as this standard is, and unattainable as it is, thank God, it does suggest the importance of our thinking. Not primarily in light of ultimate judgment, but as something appropriately disciplined by the brevity of all lives, and by acknowledgement of the extraordinary fact of one's being a consciousness capable of shaping and orienting itself. The mind, that most luxuriant flowering of the highest possibilities of the material world, likes to natter and mope and trivialize itself. We let an astonishing fertility run to weeds. I realize this statement is meaningful only if it is first granted that some thoughts, our own and others, are relatively worthy of us, or unworthy on grounds of triviality, or flatly destructive. Not much in contemporary life encourages us to make this kind of distinction. Pathology invites medical or legal intervention, of course. Short of this, we are offered strategies for making ourselves more useful to the economy, for coping with stress, or warding off dementia. We have no current language for the culture of the mind, which another generation might have called the care of the soul. There are things in reality whose limits will never be found, notably mathematics, language, and the human mind whose creatures these are. I find this fact interesting and suggestive. No doubt we will never know or find words for any meaningful fraction even of the aspects of reality that are available to our strategies of comprehension. But if this is true, it is true in fact, not in principle. High civilization and humankind itself may not last long enough to begin to discover what is potential in us, in our capacity for knowledge and understanding of the physical universe, including, of course, the things of this world. This potential is splendid and amazing, in itself more wonderful than anything it might discover, even if it were free from the limits our own choices set for it. I have found considerable resistance these days to mind as a concept. There is the brain, with its modalities. No more is granted. If it is objected that we are highly individuated, that we assimilate and interpret a great range of experience in ways that are distinctive, perhaps unique to us as individuals, well, the self has gone the way of the mind. It would seem that a new vocabulary should be supplied to acknowledge the experience of, so to speak, selfhood, but none is forthcoming, so far as I know. Absent the self, we would be free of some familiar miseries, embarrassment, anomie, alienation, not to mention self-consciousness, and we could disregard every notion of gift or calling, which do often make us restless with our actual circumstance, bent on defining ourselves in ways that dismiss or override expectation. Such experiences are excluded now from learned accounts of human being. I take this to be the case because mind and self are irreducibly complex, and this is true in part because they exist in time. They unfold, eventuate, in ways that are distinctive even when they are predictable. If we attach meaning to this existence in time, which implicates aspiration and retrospect, self-fulfillment and self-betrayal, growth and decline, then we are not captured in any moment in which, say, self-interest is enacted, or any series of such moments. We pass through time like pilgrims, always changed, and somehow always the same. We have identity through time, not only in the sense that, as Wordsworth said, the child is father of the man, but also because dreams recur and memories abide, whether or not they are welcome. Periods of trial and of insight interact in our minds not simply as memory, but as things to be pondered, whose meanings modify one another over time, and whose value changes in light of further experience. I use the word mind because this kind of inwardness is not accommodated by the word brain as it is presently understood, that is, by the exclusion of our experience of it, though it does preside over and effectively constitute our experience. If I am granted the word mind, I think I should also be permitted the word soul. I make my claim for its meaningfulness on the following grounds. First, mind, as I have described it, lacks ontological mooring. If it is like other things on earth, if animals have minds, if sensibility is a quality general among living things, possibilities I am ready to concede, then our usual conception of the nature of being is seriously defective. Second, if we extrapolate from a false notion of fundamental reality, if we say human beings must be assumed to be of a kind with everything else, and we then proceed from an impoverished view of everything else, we can only arrive at an impoverished view of human beings as well. These exclusions of concepts like mind and soul are intended as rigor and objectivity, but if they are based on fixed assumptions that are false as well as fixed, then they are only rigorous in the manner of the lesser forms of dogmatism. All this is to say that I am aware of the arguments brought against the kind of worldview faith proposes. I have given these arguments considerable thought and study, because they are important now, as they have been since at least the 18th century. It seems to be in the nature of religious concepts, notably God and the soul, to trigger skepticism. People have always tested these claims of ultimate truth against their own models of reality. Nothing is proved by the fact that these two things never align, except when religion is wrenched into conformity with human understanding and effectively ceases to be religion. If this absolute reality remains aloof from our attempts at comprehension, then it is like every deep truth about the nature of things. This proves nothing, of course, but it puts faith and doubt on the same footing, a useful beginning place for a discussion like this one. In their various articulations, these agnosticisms and atheisms have amassed prestige over time and acquired a general familiarity as well. Ground has been granted to them, uncritically, as a concession to the advance of knowledge, though often enough faith as imagined by its debunkers has little to do with faith as experience and nothing to do with the intellectual and aesthetic traditions of religion. And the supposed science that has been used as leverage against it over the centuries is too flawed, even quaint, to count as knowledge. This may in fact be where the problem arises. Those who think always in objective or positivist terms imagine God as someone somewhere, an old man enthroned on a cloud, an imaginary friend. For those who think of him metaphysically and experientially, he is the creator always creating, whom we know through divine attributes we can feel in ourselves, love, faithfulness, and compassion among them. I note here that these are attributes modern studies of the human mind do not attribute to us, at least not without converting them first into forms of self-interest, desacralizing them in effect. I concluded long ago that reverence for ourselves and reverence for God are mutually dependent, inextricable. Of course, nothing is ever so absolute as this sounds. I never mean to imagine limits to the grace of God. But I am struck by the consistency with which the traits that bind us together, that we value in one another, and that might therefore be assumed to promote survival, are excluded from this science of human nature. These are, as I have said, attributes also ascribed to God. It is certainly striking that the project that so often claims to have emptied the heavens should at the same time, conceptually at least, have stripped humanity of minds, moral natures, and selves, though there seems to be no necessity behind the simultaneity of effects. This suggests to me that our conception of the human self was as much theomorphic as our conception of God was anthropomorphic, that we discovered godlike gifts and qualities in ourselves, even as we attributed them in a vastly higher form to the Creator. To characterize God as loving or patient, aggrieved or angry, has been treated as a naive projection of our hopes and fears onto an indifferent cosmos. This view of things can be neither proved nor refuted, since belief and interpretations of experience influenced by belief on either side are quite reasonably excluded. It must be said, however, that when human nature is thought of as analogous to the nature of God, the consequences are extraordinary. For purposes of comparison with this traditional view, we have all the modern anthropologies. Various as they are entirely of one mind in avoiding the slightest suggestion that human nature has anything divine in it. In fact, it seems to be a project of theirs to minimize radically everything human in it. By human, I mean, of course, everything singular about us among the species, including our bias toward error and our gift for destruction, traditionally marks of our alienation from God, as well as our reason, imagination, and creativity. We must be shorn of a great many attributes before we can begin to seem more ape than angel, even when that angel is Lucifer. The word soul authorizes a scale and seriousness in the conception of the human being that has no equivalent when the subject is broached in any other terms. First of all, it uniquely invests each individual person with an absolute dignity and significance. One by one, we live out a passage through the world that, however opaque, is meaningful in cosmic terms. The immortality of the soul makes us all participants in an ultimate reality that transcends and in every way exceeds this transient earth. This understanding places great value in the individual and at the same time finds great significance in the moment-to-moment conduct of mortal life. There is clearly a reciprocal relationship between the idea of immortality, of an eternity that exists with reference to humankind, and the belief in the singular value and significance of human life. Each implies the other, and if we simply and utterly perish with the beasts, the conceptual universe contracts sharply. The conclusions we draw about the appropriateness of one vision or the other must be called intuitive. They are the decisions of faith. Doctrine and practice can shore up belief, even stand in the place of it, when the deeper leanings of the soul tend not to sustain it. This must mean that there is also a deeper faith behind a seeming lack or loss of faith, but the plausibility of the soul as the defining human attribute ultimately depends on our experience of ourselves and one another, and the world as well, with its power to instruct, which corresponds so tantalizingly to our prodigious ability to learn. Here is an old account of creation and our place in it. The palaces of princes are not beautified and adorned to the intent men should pay their respects and honors to the walls, but to show the grandeur and magnificence of the king, to whose person their honor is due. The world is a glorious and magnificent pile, raised designedly to exhibit the wisdom and power of its creator to the reasonable creature man, that from him God might receive the glory of all his other works. This creature man, the masterpiece of all the visible world, was therefore crowned king over it the first moment he was made. Humankind was formed of vile and despicable dust, and the consideration is humbling and serves to tame the pride of man who is apt to dote upon his own beauty. Yet it redounds to the skill and wisdom of the Creator, who out of such mean, despicable materials has fashioned so exact and elegant a piece. But the soul is the most wonderful and astonishing piece of divine workmanship. It is no hyperbole to call it the breath of God, the beauty of men, the wonder of angels, and the envy of devils. One soul is of more value than all the bodies in the world. This is from A Treatise of the Soul of Man, written in the mid-17th century by the English Puritan John Flavel. I found Reverend Flavel in a footnote to Jonathan Edwards's Treatise Concerning Religious Affections. I have both felt and sought out the influence of this tradition of Christianity, partly for its wisdom and loveliness and learning, partly because it illustrates endlessly that very much of what we think we know is in fact only the husk of old polemic. Puritans are said to have hated life, the flesh, the world, as heretics were always said to. Their writings, far from supporting this notion of them, are rich with humanist thought and with celebration of human perception and experience. Crucially, for them, beauty is a mode of divine address, a signifier of divine intention. The world is filled with sunlight, the heavens are filled with stars, our bodies are exact and elegant, and in all this the sacredness of creation is manifest, there for us to see, because our senses and minds are formed to apprehend it and glory in it. For purposes of comparison, modern anthropologies are silent on the subject of beauty, except in those cases where, by their lights, it rationalizes the selection of mates. What they do not acknowledge, they always exclude. In Edwards, the sense of beauty is the profoundest experience of consciousness, capable of a vision of the divine that is pure of any sense of self. He says, God's nature, or the divinity, is infinitely excellent. Yea, 'tis infinite beauty, brightness, and glory itself. But how can that be true love of this excellent and lovely nature, which is not built on the foundation of its true loveliness? How can that be true love of beauty and brightness, which is not for beauty and brightness' sake? And a true saint, when in the enjoyment of true discoveries of the sweet glory of God and Christ, has his mind too much captivated and engaged by what he views without himself, to stand at that time to view himself and his own attainments, it would be a diversion and loss which he could not bear to take his eye off from the ravishing object of his contemplation, to survey his own experience. So, my Puritan tells me, humankind is the masterpiece of the visible world. This is an aesthetic judgment, though it refers to all our gifts and competences. And the soul is the beauty of men. We see sacredness in one another in a particular beauty that, in the manner of sacred things, is identical with a great truth. This thought is beautiful and true to our best experience. I do not propose to argue for the truth of religion by storming the heavens, by arguing from design, or offering ontological proofs. These things are meaningful only to those who are predisposed to finding them meaningful. There is a much stronger argument to be made, beginning from Calvin's descent into the self, where, he says, one will find unmistakable marks of divinity. The soul, being both radically individual and universal among human beings, is an inexhaustible revelation of one's own nature and of the nature of every other soul who has lived, lives, and will live. The concept of the soul is the profoundest possible bond among us, an unshakable basis for compassion, recognition, and love, which, acknowledged, would enable us to love enemies, welcome strangers, and all the rest. And then there is the dignity and joy, the heightening of consciousness, that comes with the thought that each of us participates so deeply in ultimate reality. Flavel says this about language. Other creatures have apt and elegant organs. Birds can modulate the air and form it into sweet, delicious notes and charming sounds. But no creature except man, whose soul is of an heavenly nature and extraction, can articulate the sound and form it into words by which the notions and sentiments of one soul are in a noble, apt, and expeditious manner conveyed to the understanding of another soul. Something true is said here. Surely all of us have at some moment been moved by a bad poem, or the memory of an old song, or by a confession of guilt or love, even when we might not entirely trust the speaker. Theories that see language as basically functional do not account for its complex power, its ability to touch the soul, so to speak. These theories tend to be based on speculations about the motives and behavior of our remotest ancestors, of whom we know very little indeed, and are liable to misinterpreting the very little we do know. The approach may or may not make sense, but it certainly means these speculations are unconstrained except by the preferences of their formulators. In any case, a supposed original simplicity tends to be interpreted in such contexts as meaning that simplicity persists as the essential character of whatever is in question. Language is really a system of signals used to maximize self-interest. High achievement of whatever kind is really a ploy for attracting mates. Human beings are really primates with hypertrophic brains. Presumably, the manifest complexity of all these things is an accretion of simplicities, which never yields qualitative change. This makes complexity epiphenomenal, a distraction from primary reality. But in fact, complexity is totally pervasive. Consider the nucleus of an atom, or rather, consider as we can whatever it is we have tagged with names like nucleus and atom. A void is scintillant with matter and antimatter. Simplicity exists only as an idea, the abstract of a cursory reading of the given world. So by what miracle could it be essential to anything? Early evolutionary theory was bolstered by European encounters with simple people speaking simple languages, so they thought, a catastrophic error of interpretation that lives on in these theories about the primal origins of human traits and behaviors. How to find a way to reconceive virtually everything? How to rid our worldview of a systematic fault in our thinking which leads us to disallow the universe of things its terms will not accommodate? This is a difficult problem. I propose that we consult earlier writers, that we consider a cultural moment more inclined to hyperbole than to reductionism. For those who can do so in good faith, I propose a return to theist realism, by which I mean attention to the world as it is, without reductionist translation and transvaluation. To do so would be to reanimate the aesthetic vocabulary my Puritans made such free use of. If we adopt their view, that through our minds and senses we participate in absolute reality, then beauty, elegance, or charm, which we perceive as attentively as any other information, and which we replicate with remarkable nuance and fluency, is acknowledged as an active element in creation. Beauty is a conversation between humankind and reality, and we are an essential part of it, bringing to it our singular gifts of reflection and creation. Which terms, in these few sentences, would the prevailing model of reality disallow? Minds, first of all. Singular gifts, certainly. Reflection by this or any other name is not a thing I have seen mentioned in the literature. Surely experience is the test for the meaningfulness of such language. Do we reflect? My Puritan considers a lovely image of the fusion of body and soul, and rejects it in order to intensify it. Until death, he says, body and soul are even more indissoluble than light from space. Does the brain process this image? Or does the mind reflect on it? I have lived from birth with space and light, as we all do, and had never considered how they exist together. My mind is gratified by this new perception, just arrived from that distant star, the 17th century. Of course, my particular mind has had a long training in attentiveness to figurative language and to Renaissance and Reformation thought as well. It has done the autonomic business of retaining, shelving, and discarding, which predisposes any mind to distinctive interpretation of any body of knowledge. The mind has proclivities and a history. In fact, the mind is a history. In excluding it from acknowledged reality, the prevailing anthropology excludes our most defining experience of ourselves. This is consistent with the growing consensus that we have no selves. It is amazing how we disappear. My theistic realism is vastly more capacious and notoriously anthropocentric. I will quote at some length from Flavel to demonstrate Christian humanism in full flight. The soul has in itself an intrinsic worth and excellency, worthy of that divine original whence it sprang. View it in its noble faculties and durable powers, and it will appear to be a creature upon which God has laid out the riches of his wisdom and power. There you shall find a mind susceptible of all light, both natural and spiritual, shining as the candle of God in the inner man, closing with truth as the iron does with the attractive lodestone, a shop in which all arts and sciences are labored and formed. What are all the famous libraries and monuments of learning but so many systems of thoughts, labored and perfected in the active, inquisitive minds of men? Truth is its natural and delectable object. It pursues eagerly after it, and even spends itself and the body too in the chase and prosecution of truth. When it lies deep, as a subterranean treasure, the mind sends out innumerable thoughts, reinforcing each other in thick successions to dig for and compass that invaluable treasure, if it be disguised by misrepresentation and vulgar prejudice and trampled in the dirt under that disguise. There is an ability in the mind to discern it by some lines and features, which are well known to it, and both own, honor, and vindicate it under all that dirt and obloquy, with more respect than a man will take up a piece of gold or a sparkling diamond out of the mire. It searches after it by many painful deductions of reason, and triumphs more in the discovery of it than in all earthly treasures. No gratification of sense like that of the mind, when it grasps its prey for which it hunted. He goes on with his praise for the mind, then of will and conscience, the passions and the affections. He identifies the mind with the soul, and celebrates its intellectual capacities and integrity as proof of its divine original. In this he follows Calvin, elaborating on a famous passage in Institutes of the Christian Religion. Putting theology to one side, insofar as the passage permits, is he saying something true here? Is he saying something we can confirm from experience as individuals and as sharers in the life of civilization? Is the vast conceptual space he claims for the mind necessary if a true account is to be made of it? I personally am impressed by the fact that we have sent a little spacecraft beyond the solar system. Whatever unnamed truth lies behind his words, in the next paragraph he describes the study of the heavens, as Calvin did also, his account of the mind is highly consistent with human history and culture. By comparison with this or with virtually anything that lives, the human being of the modern theoretical imagination is static as a mummy, encased in its tiny, simple repertoire of motives, oddly incapable of meaningful evolution. Again, can accretions of minor calculations of self-interest, reduced as far as theorists can manage, add up to the assertions of intellect and intention Flavel describes, assertions we see continuously throughout recorded history? Is he invoking an excitement we recognize, which is different in kind from even the most cunningly concealed motive of practical self-interest? If our own experience of consciousness is meaningful as a basis for evaluating statements about consciousness, and why wouldn't it be? Then recognition is an important test of any model that is presented to us. Among the remarkable human traits Flavel does not mention, and which would not set well with his rapturous humanism, is a vulnerability to accepting low valuations of ourselves as individuals and groups that then become predictive. As a girl, I expected to be terrible at math, and I was. This might have been true in any case, but many studies confirm this effect in many settings. We can actually stupefy ourselves and one another. Recently, an undergraduate at a major university wrote about the many voices telling his generation that they would only live, work, and die. I have encountered this sort of thing among students any number of times. I'm sure it has many sources, but I see no reason to ignore the effects of the kind of teaching they receive that undertakes to describe their own nature to them. Some instructors like to shock students out of a complacency that has effectively been gone from the world since they were students themselves. Without wishing to seem judgmental, I must say I find this sort of thing brutal and destructive, a little stupid, calculated to produce a cheap effect, an iconoclasm that amounts to no more than stomping the dust of icons long shattered. No doubt this annoys me more because the pretext for it is indefensible as science. In any case, there are studies showing that positive attitudes and circumstances can be enabling, and where legitimate, it is surely the role and obligation of educators to provide them. Flavel and Calvin were both expressing the vision of the Renaissance, a period notable for intellectual fruitfulness. Be that as it may. Is there an intermediate position between the exaltation of Flavel and the extreme reductionism of contemporary theory? Flavel's faith assumes a brilliant creator God, whose attributes dignify and sanctify the creature made to share them. Neither language nor imagination could exceed the grandeur of human nature or the worth of the individual soul. Of course, they bear the marks of the fall, lovely and excellent as they are all the same. But what shall we say? How shall we conceive of it? When all spots of sin are perfectly washed off its beautiful face in heaven, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon it, and holiness and righteousness are superinduced upon this excellent creature. Do we deserve this? Can we know? The most unambiguous proof of our significance is too disheartening to be dismissed as self-aggrandizement. We should probably stop denying that we are exceptional among the creatures, now that most of us can make a list of ways we might well put an end to it all. I am not competent to speak about religions in general, but it is certainly true that Christianity has a very potent sense of the human capacity for evil. Its humanism is anchored in the doctrines of creation and fall, not at all paradoxically, since as an image of God, the essential dignity of humankind is uncompromised by acknowledged sinfulness. This is very much more complex, therefore truer to experience, than is allowed for in the entity offered by the theorists, the unmind and unself, incapable of either good or evil. And here again, the participation of humankind and of the human self in ultimate reality, assumed in religious tradition, is tacitly rejected. We know that very straight lines can be drawn between human choices and the fate of the living world. Yet nothing in this anthropology suggests that there are issues of better and worse to be engaged, choices to be made that are quite starkly moral, if anything at all is of value. I note in passing that the individualism, even solipsism, sometimes associated with experiencing oneself as a soul, is a conception that entails an ethic of love and service in a world of souls, an ideal as fully excluded from modern anthropologies as is the metaphysics that supports it. We distract ourselves from powerful ancient intuitions of the grandeur and richness of being and of human being with a reductionist theoretical contraption endlessly refitted in minor ways to survive the collapse of old scientific notions that have sustained it and to present itself once more as the coming thing, with the whole history and prestige of science behind it. Those intuitions, which figure in the highest thought and art civilization has produced, are faith. Hope. Once a minister at my church asked the congregation to reflect on their understanding of Christian hope. A lady so tiny with age that when she stood up, her hat was just visible above the pew, said, "The first thing I'll do when I get to heaven, I'll run and find my grandma. She loved me so much." Her small voice crackled with anticipation. This hope of hers was almost too confident to be called hope. But our modern understanding may have impoverished its meaning somewhat. In New Testament Greek, the word translated as hope seems to have meant something closer to expectation. In any case, some homely, profoundly beautiful thing had befallen her many decades before, and so the great drama of immortality in which she trusted was for her chiefly the occasion for one highly particular hug, scented, no doubt, with laundry starch. She imagined herself running like a child through the New Jerusalem, taking no note of its splendors, avid as a child would be for one voice, one face, one touch. Her vision is fraught with theological difficulties. What about judgment? We do give this word a darker meaning than is appropriate to it. It can mean vindication, praise, reward, as when the master in a parable finds a servant to be good and faithful. Nevertheless, Christians more or less assume that it is not a thing to be evaded. The grandmother's day of judgment might have taken into account the fact that she had figured so graciously in a child's life that the memory had been cherished through long years, keeping her, child and woman, loyal to the hope of heaven. When the grandmother was younger, and capable, by whatever tender human arts, of giving the child such utter confidence in her love, she probably had no idea that she was creating in the child a memory that could take its place among our conceptions of celestial things, even outshine them. Her reward might be, allowing as one can for the mysteries of time and timelessness, the extraordinary endless moment of love given and returned. Aha, says the skeptic. A clear case of projection of human hopes onto an indifferent cosmos. That this is a projection of human hopes is clearly true. However, that the cosmos is indifferent is not a thing that can be asserted with equal confidence. The skeptic's language implies that human beings are wholly anomalous, the universe of being an anechoic chamber in which their songs and prayers and laughter and lament are as if nothing, a sound in their own heads, talk in a dream. If this is, in fact, the case, the next question must be how this verbalizing that goes on among us relates to our collective intelligence, and then why our intelligence gives us our strange progressive access to the workings of things, notably the cosmos. Einstein and others have said that the universe is most remarkable in being comprehensible by us, and they have left the matter there. But the converse must also be true, that we are most remarkable in our ability to comprehend it. We are anomalous in being able sometimes, in some degree, to think like the universe, so to speak, which is to say that we are bound to reality otherwise and more profoundly than our biological kindred, the beasts of the field, the birds of the air. That we see this as making us alien within it is a choice, by no means inevitable or even logical. From an evolutionary point of view, our high intelligence is peacock feathers, a fluke that somehow eluded the threshing and sifting of the demands of survival until it became instrumental in our survival. There seems to be a suppressed teleology in this, wholly at odds with evolutionary theory, as if the big head and long helplessness of the first fully human infant prepared for the day, millennia incoming, when the capacities potential in her or him were sufficiently realized to compensate for these extreme vulnerabilities. There is no need to account in evolutionary terms for the very many things that are singular about us, by the lights of this schema, which is very rigorous, except when it is not. By its mode of reckoning, everything about us that can be interpreted by them as promoting the survival and propagation of the individual organism is acknowledged and accounted for, while whatever remains, for example, our tendency to wonder about our place in the universe, is somehow extraneous. And what is evolutionary theory but one major branch of the great human project of pondering just this question? Its exponents should have some insight into the impulses that drive us to expend our energies and resources mulling such things, and some insight into why these theorists assume that they can unriddle, meaningfully reduce, such a high order of complexity. This would certainly be the task of attributes their anthropology cannot describe. I return so often to this modern school of thought, because it is very widely influential, and because it is such a profound deflation of the idea of the human that where it is assumed there are no terms for speaking meaningfully about our epical species, individually or as a whole. One reads that by its lights we have neither minds nor souls. Consider what we mean by the words mindless and soulless, and how reduced a human being would have to seem in our eyes before we could begin to justify the use of such language. If we began to realize that he was in fact capable of grief or loneliness or loyalty, we would be ashamed of the estimate we had made of him. Yet we are told that humankind altogether is to be thought of in just these terms. As a consequence, we have become inarticulate in speaking and writing about the mind as the stream of reflection and emotion that it is. At the same time that we rejected the conception of a God who could be called loving or passionate, we ceased to attend to like qualities in ourselves. Even to speak of God as living is to imply attentiveness with its consequences, qualified by righteousness and by love. The modern anthropology cannot capture the vital individuality of a human being. Absent the great analogy that we are images of God, we hardly seem to know what we are. To stand apart from what we are and consider ourselves. This is definitively human. It is also definitively human to be grossly wrong about ourselves, first of all. Modern thought is represented as having escaped and renounced the errors of the past. This means, whatever else, that our propensity to err even catastrophically is conceded. The concession does not in any way reduce our liability to further error, a fact far too seldom taken into account. Early Darwinism was the handmaiden of racial science. Early genetics was the handmaiden of eugenics. I will not mention nuclear energy and its crude and naive beginnings, whose consequences will play themselves out literally forever. The horrible children of half-baked science are the result of misplaced optimism, confidence so insistent on its own justification that it scorns reasonable doubt. This, while it prides itself on rigorous skepticism. But my subject is hope, the theological virtue, which I would distinguish very sharply from what I have called optimism. Hope implies a felt lack, an absence, a yearning. Come quickly, Lord Jesus. The father of the prodigal son hopes for his return. We know that he watches for him. Nothing in the parable implies that he has any grounds for confidence that his son will return. Certainly nothing we know about the young man's character or affection for his family. In fact, the father's hope is based solely on his love for his son. He yearns for a wholeness only his son can supply. If his son, finally returned, is no better than he was when he left, his father will hope for some glimpse of a sign that this is not only, or always, or essentially true. Hope is loyalty. It seems that earthly love is always compounded with hope. Skeptics say the religious project their feelings onto an empty heaven. It is important to consider what these feelings are, how they exist in the world of things, as they certainly do. Love is in its nature projected, a spontaneous assertion of one's own perception on an earthly reality, a reality that could as well be called empty, at least indifferent. This is the sociopathic view. It is entirely possible, in fact very common, to love where there is no trace of reciprocity and no prospect of it. If the rebel Absalom had returned to his father David and asked his forgiveness, this would have answered a hope of David's, certainly. If Absalom had only survived his insurrection, David's most desperate hope would have been fulfilled. Neither of these things happen, and David's love for his son is undiminished. If love is greater than hope, as Paul says it is, this may be true in part because love is prior to hope, a condition of it, and is fulfilled when hope falls away, fulfilled if in fact it ever is fulfilled. Again, I am speaking of hope, the theological virtue that ranks with faith and love, not of any transient casual state of mind that might be called by the same name. That tiny lady I mentioned, whose expectations have been long since put to the test, had built her conception of heaven around a hope of restored and renewed love. I believe this is often the case, whether the object of love is a person or an idea or God himself. Love never ends, the apostle tells us. Projected forward, it is hope. What it would be, fully realized, we can imagine only because we experience hope as absence. Blessed are you who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for you shall be filled. Blessed are you who mourn, for you shall be comforted. I mentioned the sociopathic view of things, which sees the world as valueless, as exciting neither affection nor loyalty. Then there is the sort of person who loves and is loyal, even so it might appear to others, in defiance of common sense. King David, the father in the parable. And, by implication, God the Father. In human terms, who has the better sense of reality? The man who knows about love only by report, or the man who, in the face of a terrible betrayal, will still say, "My son, my son"? Granting that this is the father we would all wish to find waiting for us, does this mean the hope is baseless, a delusion to which we are attracted or subject because we are aliens in the universe? But what possible grounds do we have for saying that we are in fact aliens? If nature, in the reductionist sense, is all there is, then we can only be fully as much a part of it as a mollusk or a stone. If reality is to be thought of as saturated with a strange brilliance, as science that does actual research continuously tells us it is, then we are very much a part of that. And if we are an exceptional expression of a pervasive brilliance, a creature uniquely suited to knowing, that is, to science, then we should feel a certain respect for our means of knowing, fallible as they always are. Our ideas are subjective, inescapably influenced by circumstance.